Good morning. The cost to enforce Honolulu's stored property ordinance and clean up after the homeless costs $15,000 weekly. Could that money and the price tag to create temporary Sand Island housing be better used? Hawaii Appleseed's Jenny Lee joins us this hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Neil Conan is taking time out from farm work for Kamehameha Day. We'll look at the holiday through his eyes a little later.
It was a Broadway comedy hit. Now it's making the long leap to Hawaii. Joe Moore is on hand to tell us about the regional theater debut of Terrence McNally's It's Only a Play. And Kumukahua director Will Kahele is preparing a challenging new production and offering a workshop in how to audition. It's a morning of theater folk on The Conversation.
And those conversations for this Kamehameha Day start right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Had to play a little segment of Ornette Coleman. We just lost him. He's a very influential jazz artist to several generations now.
And thanks to recordings like the one we just heard, we can still tap our toes and enjoy.
Exactly.
All right. Well, here we are on this Kamehameha Day and a lot to talk about. Thanks very much for joining us. Now, 2 days ago, the Kapalama Canal saw a lot of comings and goings. Crews collected the belongings of the homeless people living along the canal and cleaned up after them. The crew was enforcing Honolulu's stored property ordinance. Hours later, the homeless people returned. The cycle is ordinary and costly. According to the city, the weekly price tag to enforce the law is $15,000. Jenny Lee believes that money and the funds to create temporary housing at Sand Island could be better used. She's the public policy director for Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. She's in our studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
That's a lot of money when you start to think about how much it might cost to get a unit for someone if there were a subsidy available, or maybe even if there weren't. And if you're talking about getting a unit for somebody at about $1,000 a month, to think about what $15,000 weekly could buy, plus the additional funds that are being used for Sand Island. Why isn't this really being talked about with sort of a cost-benefit analysis?
I think that there's such concern that people see that we've reached a crisis point in terms of homelessness. This issue has been kicked down the road for quite some time now, and therefore there's a feeling that we need to take immediate concrete action that people can see. So similar with the sit-lie bans, there's an approach thinking that if we just sweep people out of this area by removing their property, or we try to put people in Sand Island, if we can present some kind of solution, then it indicates progress. But we think that there are other options that also would make more of an impact and be more cost efficient. So that figure of $15,000, you could give a full voucher for a year to at least a couple, and that many of the people experiencing homelessness are actually working or would be able to, with supportive services, find employment of some kind. We do have a low unemployment rate. And then, therefore, even if it's part-time, be able to give some income to help reduce the amount of that subsidy. So we think it could go far with a shallow form of subsidy as well.
Your point that, okay, people want to see something happening immediately. They want to see some action on this. Well, seeing people removed from an area or their belongings removed from an area, obviously that's immediate action. But then you get one right after that where people come back. Surely people are seeing that too. In light of what you've just said, is there any movement to look at this idea of putting them into housing and doing what we've all been talking about for such a long time with Housing First?
The city council did allow a shallow subsidy in its provision for funds for homeless programs. So that is an option should the city administration decide to exercise it. And we do think this really should be pursued because it is a cost-efficient way to address it, and I think it's promising. So we're looking at a lot of things that we either know don't work or haven't tried before. And we say, okay, this is a good option, like Sand Island. We are considering this, and we'll just see if it works, and then maybe we'll replicate it. But this is an option that we also have not tried, taking a coordinated approach to really help place people who are in these situations where they are far from ideal. I think there's a distinction between Kapalama and Kaka'ako. You do have certain things like being right near the stream, issues with waste disposal that do present some health concerns. So I think that's a real emergency area where we need a coordinated placement effort. And rental assistance is a huge part of that.
So why all the myopia on the Sand Island option?
I think that it's to some extent looking at options that have been successful in some sense elsewhere. So in the West Coast, particularly the Pacific Northwest, there have been these kind of voluntary communities that arose organically out of encampments and people self-selecting to enter into them. But the residents tend to be there longer term. They have a real interest in being a part of that community. So I've spoken with some of those folks in Oregon, and there's a real passion for being a part of that. Sand Island is essentially another emergency shelter. And we know that the exit destinations for people coming out of emergency shelters, more than half of them are going back into homelessness. So we need to see that Sand Island is not really some kind of transitional housing. Emergency shelter placement is one acceptable outcome. And then also we know that the outcomes, it is a struggle. And it's not to say point fingers or say it's anybody's fault necessarily, but what's going to make Sand Island different? I think we can't underestimate the importance of the location and the disruption that's coming to people from a sense of breaking apart from their community and going out there. It's not simply barriers to entering shelters, but those kind of things also matter. And those kind of goals by people who are unsheltered, what their priorities are and what they care about. We really need to look at the comprehensive set of barriers. Why aren't they going into the existing shelter beds, especially when we have 150 vacant emergency shelter beds and then another 450 in transitional housing, which is what the step is supposed to be to get you into permanent housing, but people aren't there.
Why aren't they there?
I think some of those issues related to there has been more discussion about some of the barriers in terms of how people feel about the policies in a shelter, whether or not they can live with their partner, whether or not they can have a pet there, the periods where the shelters close, they have to leave very early, they can't come back till later. So those kinds of things, they do make life more difficult for people who have experienced trauma and are really struggling. Location also matters, whether people feel they're close to where they want to live or even close to resources, jobs, libraries, all these sorts of things where they're that any of us would want in our community. So I think it's multifaceted, but we need to take a hard look at that, because what's the difference again with Sand Island? And that's one of the most difficult locations. It does not look very hospitable, and it's not very conveniently located. So until we really identify that, if we're talking about this being a promising model, well, it's a little cart before the horse to think about where are we beginning, what's the problem we're looking to solve. And it's not simply going to be a kind of private 40-square-foot space to put your belongings in. Those are improvements, but we should consider what's going on then, what's good about this proposal that we could try to look at how we can implement elsewhere.
What you seem to be saying is that there are more redundancies with the Sand Island plan than there are benefits. Would that be true?
At least in terms of what the number of beds are, I think that's there, and that some of the things, the aspects that we can probably all look at and support could be replicated elsewhere, including the, in addition to the emergency shelter beds, as I think, again, we have to emphasize, this really is an emergency shelter with a 60-day time limit on residing there. Also looking at the intake, there's an idea that this is kind of a one-stop shop to come in and do intake. Well, it's in an incredibly isolated location. That would not be my first choice for where I try to go. So we do have certain options for where sites where people can go for intake, existing service providers, but they're very, very popular, which is a great sign. People want access to these services. But I think we should take a look at expanding staffing and the number of people already at shelters or other sites where people experiencing homelessness may congregate. So, for example, a food distribution site. What if we had, even if it was just one day a week, a part-time intake site that we could start connecting people where they're already going, where they're comfortable, instead of building infrastructure and an entire new program?
And that's been the point all along, that in terms of doing any sort of triage, you already know where homeless people are or where they would congregate if there were something given to them at a point where they need it, like the food.
Right. And we also have great teams of street outreach workers who consistently go out there and really try to maintain and build trust with these clients, and then do that exact process, go through the assessment, the vulnerability index, and then help them connect with the services. And that kind of trust-building relationship with these dedicated staff is really important. SitLie, though, has been one component that's disrupted that.
As you look at where we are right now, and given all the things that you've just said, what do you think is the assessment that decision-makers are looking at? Are they actually looking at the same sets of information that you are?
I think that some of the pieces of information have not come out in as much of a public discussion about the number of people who are capable of a rapid rehousing approach. It's not only housing first, but there are cost-efficient things we can do to address the populations we're really concerned about. We know that our policymakers do care about these people and are trying to think of, well, what can we do in terms, particularly of Sand Island, like, is this a more humane option or something that people would be open to? So when they start considering what works, what will people respond to, that's a step in the right direction, but we have to look at the data that's been collected by groups like Focus to understand that, and then see also input what's keeping residents out of unsheltered people out of shelters and out of housing. So that's really the point to start at, is that information, what is going to be successful through that kind of analysis.
And on that point where you say that we should start, we have to end for the moment. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Bethann.
Jenny Lee is a public policy director for Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. She's also the secretary of the Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii and on the board of Housing Hawaii. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:16. Later in the show, living inside the anxieties of theater folk for an opening night. But hey, it's only a play. First, though, your backyard quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're taking a look at local musician Dean Taba. A master of the electric and double bass, Dean has performed and recorded with a wide range of artists, such as Jake Shimabukuro, Rhythm Summit, the San Francisco Symphony, Daniel Ho, and countless others. Along with his abilities as a performer, he's also been a part-time clinician and educator at the Los Angeles Music Academy, Musicians Institute, and Cal Poly Pomona. As a solo artist, he has several albums, like the Camarillo Waltz, that display his original jazz compositions. At the age of 6, he began his musical studies on the piano and went on to play an instrument in the Hawaii Youth Symphony. For today's Backyard Quiz, we want you to tell us which instrument he played. You can call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. If you're the first caller with the correct answer, you'll win an HPR t-shirt.
Good morning. My name is Nicole Lamb, and I'm the Arts Director for Moments Unforgettable. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
There's so much work that goes into the production of a Broadway play and so much anxiety attached to the opening night, when good reviews can mean job security and adulation for years to come, and bad ones can plunge you into oblivion. It's an ideal setup for comedy, which loves trouble, and the playwright Terrence McNally knows whereof he speaks. In its original version, the show that became It's Only a Play closed out of town. It went on to become a Broadway hit full of delicious theatrical inside humor. Now it's making a transcontinental leap to the Hawaii Theater with Joe Moore and a cast of well-known local players. And Joe's with us this morning. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Chris.
I guess the first thing to say is it's very unusual for a play to come to a regional theater that quickly after its Broadway run.
We got really lucky. I had seen this play on Broadway and approached Mr. McNally and said how much I admired it and would love to bring it out here to our beautiful historic Hawaii Theater.
Uh-huh.
And we would be doing a professional production as a benefit for the theater. And he thought about it for a couple of days and said, sure, I'll grant you the rights. And at the time, I was too dumb to know that that's not how it works.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, normally you go through the publishing house that owns the rights. Well, because he had totally reworked it from the earlier version, it's almost, I'd say, 90% a new play for anyone who might have seen it when it ran off-Broadway in the 80s and then in L.A. in the 90s. This, you're going to see a different play. And so to grant the rights is almost unheard of, to get them right from the playwright while it's still running on Broadway. Now it has just closed this past Sunday, and so we become the first theater in the country to do it following its Broadway run.
The setup of the action is a delightful one because, you know, whenever you can have people with sort of seething anxieties, you've got a recipe for comedy, right?
Yes, and it gets you this behind-the-scenes look at an opening night Broadway party upstairs while the raging party is going on downstairs with all these big stars. Upstairs in the producer's luscious bedroom, there are some principals that are commiserating and sharing their angst over waiting for the all-important New York Times to review to come out. Linda Pearl, national actress, Broadway and TV and films, we were lucky to get her to play the producer. So it's taking place in her apartment. The play's author, played by our Hawaii actor Paul Mitri, and his best friend, a former stage actor who's turned down the play for a TV series. That's the role I play. There's a diva actress who, shall we say, knows her way around pharmaceuticals. That's played by our Kathy Foy, and she's going to bring the house down with her portrayal. There's a young off-the-wall British director played by Ryan Wusterwald, who was a former UH theater major and now a successful actor in New York. He's coming back for this. There's a vicious, pretentious theater critic who has snuck into the party for reasons I shall not reveal here. That's played by Tom Holowak over at the Palikou Theater. And a just-arrived from Hawaii wannabe actor who is checking coats at the party. Desmond Gila plays that role, and that is our cast.
So everybody's got all kinds of stuff going on.
Yes.
Right?
There's a lot of backbiting and gossip and name-dropping, and it's I swear to goodness, it is the funniest play I personally have ever seen. Not just been part of. You know, I've done Odd Couple and The Honeymooners and Heaven Forbid out here. But when I saw this on Broadway, I was just dying with laughter, as was the audience. I mean, it was a blockbuster hit. They were extended twice, and it's just hilarious, especially for anyone who likes live theater, either as an audience member, and it goes an even a level deeper. If you've ever acted, you really will really get behind a lot of what's going on.
I would think, Joe, if you've ever approached anything with a great deal of anxiety and had a lot riding on opening night, whatever it was,
right?
You could really
you'll relate.
Your character has turned the play down. And is in a way, is he secretly relieved that it might not be, you know, if it turns out to be a hit, he's going to feel like a jerk, right?
It's a very interesting aspect of this character I play, James Wicker, who was played by Nathan Lane on Broadway.
Boy.
Hello, try and step into those shoes. It's going to be a great challenge for me personally. But he's the best friend of the playwright, but he didn't like the play when it was offered to him. And
that was awkward.
Yeah, that was right there would be an awkward situation. And then he sort of got bailed out because he did a TV pilot that then went on, has been running for like 9 seasons. So now he's coming back to see this opening night show. So now he's seen it. And he has, as you might well imagine, has divided emotions. He doesn't, you know, he wants his friend to succeed, but on the other hand, he wants the play to fail so he could be justified in turning it down.
Yeah. Yeah, he's going to feel silly if it turns.
There's some very interesting dynamics that add to the silliness and craziness of the evening.
Well, because you know you have this thing with show folk where you know everything's lovey-dovey, but inside it might be quite the opposite. Right?
Yeah, you're saying one thing, and inside you're thinking totally opposite.
Sometimes you know the whole idea of turmoil and seething emotions they lend themselves just as well to comedy as to drama.
And as in most great comedies, there are some very touching and poignant moments in this, you know, and heated moments. It's not just all slapstick and farce. There's some very personal moments that I think people will also relate to.
Because there has to be something at stake, right?
Yes.
Otherwise, comedy just becomes mere farce and just one joke after another. That doesn't work either.
No, I mean, you could do that for a while, and obviously some one-liners are funny on their own, but when you put them into the whole context of what's happening over the course of this evening, it's pretty not only hilarious but pretty deep.
You also one of the impressions I've gotten about the play is that it allows the playwright to sort of make a few comments about critics and their role.
Does Mr. McNally do that? Yes. You know, and some of the one particular line I'm thinking of that comes out of the play, a critic says something about the playwright in this our particular production, and he's saying, gosh, should I give this away or not? Yeah, might as well, because this really happened to Terrence McNally on his first Broadway play. The critic wrote, "The theater world would be a better place today if Mr. McNally's parents had smothered him in his crib."
Oh, my God.
Now, this is a young Terrence McNally at the time, his first Broadway play, and that's what's printed in the paper.
That's no wonder.
You know, that's a little harsh, yes.
Perhaps a little harsh, yeah. That's sort of extending the critic's role perhaps a little bit more than...
Yeah. So, but it's... And to Mr. McNally's credit, he pokes fun at everybody, not just critics and the actors, but at himself as a playwright and some of his insecurities.
That's the way it's got to be, Joe. Yeah. Sounds like a great show. Thanks.
Oh, we're having so much fun with rehearsals. I hope people can come. It runs June 18th, starting a week from tonight, June 18th through the 28th, 11 performances at Hawaii Theater.
I don't think you're going to have real opening night anxieties the way they're portrayed here, at least.
Hopefully not to that degree. We'll have some, of course, butterflies, but that's always very good for an actor.
You bet. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thank you, Chris.
Joe Moore, Linda Pearl, and Kathy Foy head the cast of Terrence McNally's It's Only a Play, running at the Hawaii Theater from June 18th to 28th. You can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
words, words everywhere, but not a book in sight.
It's really about developing a love for reading, a passion for the written word, finding that spark in a child, and making sure that they're a reader for life.
Opportunities to read are everywhere, but is long-form lit a turnoff to kids? Taking a summer book vacation with LeVar Burton. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
Forget for just a moment the money needed to make up the shortfall to build Honolulu's rail. What about the money needed to run and maintain it? It seems Hart may have forgotten about that, too. Civil Beat has been analyzing all the documents in its off-track series. Reporter Chad Lair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, we talked about this way, way, way back when, you know, years and years and years ago, that it's not just a matter of what monies are needed to build it, but what do you need to operate it? And it seems from your investigation that those monies have indeed been forgotten.
Well, there certainly is a lack of detail forthcoming on how they're going to pay for this. So what Bob Porterfield and Nick Ruby, our reporters, looked at is the financial projections from Hart, from the Rail Authority, on how to, you know, take care of the operating and maintenance costs. And so when the rail starts at first leg in 2019 till about 2031, those costs will exceed $1.7 billion. Well, the revenue that's predicted to come from the fare that they're going to charge to ride the train, that's only going to cover a third. So the big question is, where are you going to get the rest of that money, $1.2 billion? And, you know, the way things are going with cost overruns and delays, that figure could certainly grow.
And wind up in our tax bills for our properties, perhaps?
Very much so. You know, Ben Cayetano was interviewed for the story, and you know, he was a rail opponent, ran for mayor, lost to Kurt Caldwell. But he says, you know, the city may have to look at property taxes or extending that surcharge again, even if Governor Ige signs that bill, the surcharge extension, which is on his desk. That's only for 5 years. And by the way, that bill does not apply to operating and maintenance costs. It only applies to the capital costs, you know, the engineering, the designing, and the building. So Jill Takuda, who runs Ways and Means in the Senate, says it's alarming that these costs for the operating of the rail system are unknown at this point, even though we're moving closer and closer to seeing this thing running.
Which goes back again to that same argument that a lot of rail opponents were saying years and years ago, that those costs were really not factored in. And also to the argument that a temporary increase or a temporary tax was not going to be so temporary.
Right. And there have been studies just in April, the FDA consultants, the FTA rather, said, you know, where's that money going to come from? That it's not going to add up. There was another shortfall predicted 3 years ago. There are some funding mechanisms that the city will probably be looking at, the mayor and the council. One possibility is to have advertising on the train. Another is to sell the naming rights to the stations. You could charge for broadband. But boy, is that really going to add up to $1.2 billion or more? Do you have to look at maybe using bonds to get some revenue? So these are big concerns. One other thing that Bob and Nick found out or predict is that those shortfalls for the operation and maintenance could actually come up sooner than has been expected.
How soon?
Well, very soon. Remember, this thing's supposed to be done by 2022. They could come as soon as that first leg, which is what from East Kapolei to Aloha Stadium, if things are on target. That's going to start in 2019. So I think we'll be seeing it within just a few short years.
All right. And not necessarily with short-term fixes that are going to take care of long-term needs.
Right.
Thanks, Chad. Obviously, we'll have another conversation or six or seven or eight or ten about this one. Thanks so much. Have a good rest of the holiday. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Chad Blair reports on politics for Civil Beat.
Tonight at 5, Bethann, you'll be bringing us Town Square, and the Hawaii State Teachers Association election has finally resolved itself, yeah?
It has resolved itself, and we're going to be talking with new leadership tonight, headed by Corey Rosenlee, now the incoming president. Justin Huey will be here, Amy Peruso, and we're going to talk to them about what they see in this transitionary period until they effectively do take control of HST and its leadership, and what happens afterward.
Well, it was really clear from the controversy over the do-over of the election that there were different schools of thought within the union, yeah?
Very different schools of thought. And now that that's been decided, the question is, will all of this keep coming back to haunt them, or are they going to be able to move forward and do some of the things that led them to run in the first place?
Well, of course, their task now is really consolidation of with the membership, yeah.
And moving it in a different direction. That was what they were trying to do from the very beginning. So we'll see what they have planned for that. That's coming up tonight at 5 o'clock. And, yeah, we know it's a holiday, but we hope you'll plan to join us for a live show back here in the studio at 5 o'clock and call in. You can do that, too, tonight at Town Square.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, whose employees and their families volunteer with local charities, including the Coastal Cleanup, the Hawaii Food Bank, and the American Heart Association's Heart Walk.
It's the King Kamehameha holiday. Many people have the day off, maybe even you. It also includes Neil Conan, though as the owner of a macadamia nut farm, work is never far away. Still, he made it down to see some of the ceremonies in North Kohala today, and then back to the farm where he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Happy Kamehameha Day.
And you too. I can hear birds tweeting behind you. That's lovely.
Yes.
When you were down in Kohala this morning, this was your second Kamehameha Day. What do you make of all of this, as once it was just sort of academic and something that happened in Hawaii, but now this is happening in your hometown?
Oh, it's a big deal here. Of course, Kamehameha was born not far from where I am now, maybe 5 miles away in Kapa'au, was raised here partly. Kohala was his political and military and logistical base during his conquering days. So this is an incredibly important part of the islands for Kamehameha, and there's the original Kamehameha statue stands in Kapa'au. Of course, there's another one in your town, Honolulu, and there's another one in Hilo, of course. But it is such an important deal for all of the people here, and yes, of course, the Native Hawaiians. I did get a chance just to see the Royal Order of Kamehameha marching into the Kapa'au town center as the ceremonies began this morning, and I was listening to Boyd Bond, who's a Kohala historian, talking about some of the aspects of King Kamehameha. He's such a fascinating figure. I'm just beginning to learn about him. Of course, we learn about back east where I grew up, you learn about European royalty and the histories of England and France and that sort of thing. You don't get much about King Kamehameha, but he's this fascinating figure. He's this sort of combination of King Alfred the Great, who, of course, was the person who established the polity that would become England. And there's a bit of King Arthur, too.
and as you are looking at all of this now and putting this together with everything that you bring to it, you're also making the sound that this is now becoming a big deal for you, too, is it?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I'm beginning to understand a little bit about what it means to be from here. That word aina. I'm just beginning to, I know what the literal translation is. I'm just beginning to understand what the word itself is beginning to mean. It may be a long time, if ever, before I totally understand it. I'm beginning to understand why it is important for people here to say they live on the island of Hawaii, not on the big island, that this is a place that's more than a nickname, as they put it. People get sensitive about seemingly silly sounding things, but there's been this whole resurgence of and I think we've been here for a bit of it, this whole resurgence of a spirit that it's sort of focused now around the 30-meter telescope. And again, it's an issue that I'm struggling to understand.
As you say, you're struggling to understand some of this stuff, though. You're still there and engaging with everyone and putting your hands into that earth every day and being responsible for a big piece of land. That's got to change the way you regard how this conversation happens.
It does. It forces me to rethink things again. It's not such a big piece of land. It's 5.5 acres. It's a big piece of land for me.
From Honolulu, that sounds like a big piece of land.
Okay. From Queens, it sounds like a big piece of land, too. But up here in this part of the island, there's plenty of people who have a lot more land than that. The Parker Ranch is just over the hill. They've got a little bit of land. So one of the things, in fact, that makes this so unique here in Kohala is that there's a parade that's going to kick off. Well, it's Hawi. It's scheduled to kick off in about 20 minutes. But many of the participants are the Paniolos from the various ranches. The biggest one, of course, is Parker Ranch. And that makes it such an interesting event as they ride down on their horses and wearing the leis around their hats and incredibly competent looking people.
Incredibly beautiful, too. So, Mr. Conan, are we going to see you aboard a horse anytime soon?
Not just a few years ago, the only horse I'd been around was wooden and went around in circles. But I spent a couple of weeks in Alaska at a place in an outfit up in the Wrangell, St. Elias, near the Canadian border, and rode horses for 2 weeks through raging streams up to my hips, through upslope. It was really interesting. We didn't go past a walk much, but it was pretty interesting.
All right, so the intrepid Mr. Conan is not afraid of horses, although don't ever give you a chainsaw. I know that part. As you are...
No, don't give me a chainsaw.
No, never, never, never. Because this is such an important part of where you are living now, are you considering getting involved in other ways besides what you've been able to do in the last year and a half, 2 years?
Well, we'll see how it breaks out. I don't want to force things. I certainly don't want to force myself on any situation. I've been involved in the community radio station that's being built here that's supposed to go on the air in the summer. But again, the Bigfoot from back east, I try to issue advice if they ask. But it's something that's got to develop on its own. And so I'll be very interested to see how it comes out. You don't want to impose yourself on a situation. And so these things, I think, develop best organically. So what happens, happens.
Always a good thing to know that you should tread lightly when you come into a new community. But there you are. You're still part of it. And no doubt there will be many more things for you to do. So as you look at today's holiday and maybe getting a slight break from having to do farm work, what's the rest of your day look like?
Well, as soon as we hang up, I'll drive down to Hawi. The highway, the Akonepule, is closed for the parade, so I can only get to see it down in Hawi, which is the beginning point. They march a couple of miles down the road to Kapa'au and then into King Kamehameha Park, and there's some ceremonies there. And it's a pretty interesting day, so I'll look forward to it.
Well, good. Go off and enjoy it. We wish you a lovely day, and thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Thanks, Bethann.
Thanks, Neil. Neil Conan has added organic macadamia nut farmer to his list of credits. It's far from his city life at NPR. We'll talk about how he combines both lives in our weekly conversation from the farm. Now, some pictures of his first Kamehameha Day last year and a few from this morning will be up on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. Now, this morning, we're going to get back to our backyard quiz. And we told you a little earlier about local bass player Dean Taba, a master of the electronic and acoustic bass. Dean Taba has performed and recorded with a range of artists, Jake Shimabukuro, Jeff Lorber, Rhythm Summit, the San Francisco Symphony, Daniel Ho, and countless others. Along with his performing career, though, he's also been a part-time educator at the Los Angeles Music Academy, Grove School of Music, and Cal Poly Pomona. He's produced several albums as a solo artist, And but before all of that, though, he, at the age of 6, began playing the piano and also went on to play an instrument in the Hawaii Youth Symphony. And for today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to tell us what that instrument was, and we actually had someone call us who knew that it is the French horn.
And that person was Nancy Marker, who was the first to call and let us know, so she gets a T-shirt. Thanks, Nancy, at 8:46. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Good morning. I'm DeSoto Brown from Bishop Museum. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Kumukuhua Theater has built its reputation on theater by the people, for the people, so every casting call brings with it the possibility of discovering new local talent. But auditions tend to go best for those who know how to audition, and with that in mind, director Will Kahele is holding an audition workshop open to all. He's on hand with some ideas about how to prepare. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Sure. We're not going to say that this will make auditioning easy, are we? Because I don't think there's a way to make it easy.
No, I think everybody, even me, I still get nervous, you know, sure, going to auditions.
Well, you have to put a lot into a fairly short time, mm-hmm, and you've got to get everything you've got kind of right up front all at once, yeah?
Yep. You just go out there and you try your best, and you make sure they... the people there, like the directors, you know, they see what you can do and you just go for it.
But there are things that the experienced know to do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. As far as like, you know, reading the lines and seeing what the character is going through, and, you know, you make your little character backgrounds as you're reading and you, mm-hmm, see what's going on. And if you can, you get some history on the play, or you get the script in advance of the audition, mm-hmm, and you read up and you kind of build your own character.
Well, because usually in an audition, don't you just get that character and those scenes? You don't necessarily get overall context, yeah?
Correct. But some theaters do offer the script ahead of the audition, so you can peruse it and
which would be a good idea to
do.
Yeah. Right?
Always. Always present your best. Present your best foot forward, you know, when you go to auditions.
You have to, I would think, give a lot of attention to not just obviously memorizing the lines, but what is my state of mind, my character's state of mind when I'm saying these things.
Right. And another good thing is to be able to change your tact, or, you know, to be able to change the way you're presenting the character. Like if the director says, okay, that was great, can you do it this way? And,
yeah,
you know, give you another a suggestion and then see how well you take that. Because then they look at how easy it is to work with a certain actor, if they can take direction, or, you know, if they're not too keen on taking direction yet.
If it doesn't do a director much good if actors are all locked into an
interpretation. Right, because, you know, you kind of like bang your head on the table.
Yeah. And you've been in both.
Oh, yeah, both.
Both,
yeah,
places,
yes,
right?
Yes, a lot.
Well, the play that you're going to be casting, Joker,
mm-hmm, yes,
is a play where, let's see, people are, I mean, there's some complexity to all this. There are people who are keeping things hidden, have kept things hidden throughout their lives.
Yes.
Secrets that are kept between one character and another. That's tricky to evoke, isn't it?
It is tricky to evoke. And hopefully the main character, Joe, or Joker, that actor will be able to have the audience see through his eyes what he's going through and the emotions he's feeling without really saying the words.
Yeah, that's the trick, right?
Right, right, right.
And this particular character for this play is a Filipino male of what age?
He's in his 40s, and he is an immigrant from the Philippines. He came to Hawaii, and he was an activist. He was a writer in the Philippines, and he's come to Hawaii. And
activist for gay rights.
Activist for gay rights. And he's a gay man, and he fell in love with a Chinese man who was married, had a wife, had a kid. They had a small business, a small Chinese restaurant. And of course, the Chinese guy wasn't out. And so they kind of lived in secret. They were like best friends. And he dies. And to keep a promise to his lover, Joe, or Joker, marries the widow and raises the son.
So he's keeping a lot of secrets.
He's keeping a lot of secrets, right? And it's about him not letting go of this promise that he's kept to this man. As various pressures start to come in, and we see a friend of his from the Philippines come in as gay marriage is now coming to the forefront in Hawaii. Yeah. So, of course, they want a marriage equality in the Philippines too. So his friend comes from the Philippines to Hawaii to bring Joker back to the Philippines so that he could be active in marriage equality back in the Philippines.
So he's a disruptor.
Yes.
Big time.
Yes, yes. He's the antagonist.
Yeah. And that's sort of one of the fundamentals of theater, right?
Yes.
Somebody's pushing in one direction, somebody's got to push back in the other, and drama ensues.
Oh, and everything in the middle, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a four person play, so it's gonna be a tight cast, and it's gonna be a lot of fun. I'm really excited.
It also sounds, Will, as if the lines aren't going to do everything for you as an actor. That there's an awful lot you're going to have to do beyond what is said, right?
Yes, yes.
Especially, you know, whenever characters have a secret, you know, you can't just state the secret, right?
Right,
so how do you evoke it?
just through acting, or I don't know, nuances. This play played earlier. Last year, I believe, at the University of Hawaii, when
the MFA,
Yilong Liu, and it played for a weekend, and I was fortunate enough to see it, and I was blown away. And they had 3 weeks to put it all together and put it to the public, and buzz went out, you know. And when I saw it, I went, "Wow, there's so much more one could do with this." And then when it caught the attention of Harry Wong, artistic director, I lobbied to direct it. You know, I said, "Please, Harry, please, please, please let me direct it."
Yeah.
And of course, I had to go through a lot of hurdles to to convince Harry that I could do it. And he consented, or maybe he relented.
And hey, the results the same, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so it's going to be exciting to follow with, and you know, when the production gets off the ground, we'll talk again. Will,
okay.
It's interesting, I think, to talk about a play when it's just an idea in your head. You haven't even seen the actors yet.
Right, so. Right, yeah, and yeah. Audition workshops are this Saturday.
Yeah,
and you know, we encourage everybody to come out and just have fun.
We'll see if we can't make some discoveries along the
way.
Yeah,
I hope so. I hope so. We've made a couple this season.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Chris.
You bet. Will Kahele, director at Kumukuhua Theater in downtown Honolulu, will hold auditions for Kumu's 45th season opening show, Joker, by Yilong Liu, Saturday and Sunday, June 20th and 21st. But he'll also lead an audition workshop the prior weekend, Saturday, June 13th at 2 p.m. You can learn more about on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Thank you.
on the next Radiolab.
Couple of hotties getting it on across the window.
We wonder what we should or shouldn't see across the street.
I just watched the window all the time.
Hey, stop photographing.
Through a camera lens.
I'm not sure you want to see these photos.
I had no idea. It was just like this beautiful love story.
And up close, face to face.
Well, I never wanted to be part of their lives.
That's on the next Radiolab.
Saturday morning at 10.
Beth Ann, we had a real theatrical bent on today's show. And one of the things about Joe Moore's production of It's Only a Play is it's a very recent Broadway hit. And his description of how he brought it to Hawaii had to do with his sort of not knowing that you weren't supposed to just ask the playwright fresh on the heels of a production. And everybody said yes.
Well, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and it's a very good thing when you don't.
Exactly. You're sort of, you can bypass the protocols, and people turn out to be pretty accommodating.
Yeah. Well, it also goes back to that idea that you never know if you don't ask.
Exactly.
So why not? Anyway, that's going to do it for us. We'll be asking more questions and having more conversation with you tomorrow. And on the agenda, we have Regional Administrator for the EPA's Pacific Southwest Region, Jared Blumenfeld, will be here.
And the Honolulu Downtown Celebration of Sailor Jerry and pianist Sarah Davis Buchner be with us in our studio.
In the meantime, we'd like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line to leave your comments. That number is 808-792-8217. Our email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And on Facebook, we're Hawaii Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive. Links to more information about guests and topics are there too. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vandergrift.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Meet us in the morning for more of the conversation.